The following talk was given by Steve Hagen in Minneapolis on July 14, 1997. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good evening.
Good evening.
And we're on our fifth meeting, I guess, huh? The Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I want to just pick it up where we left off. I think we're just starting page 77. Okay, near the top, he says, the moment you meet a teacher, you should leave the teacher, and you should be independent. So, but stick around, you know. But you should leave the teacher, and you should be independent. You need a teacher so that you can become independent. And if you are not attached to him, the teacher will show you the way to yourself. If you're not attached to him or her, well, I haven't really talked about this, but whether you're a man or a woman in Zen, doesn't matter. Anybody who can see isn't going to discriminate on the basis of whether you're a man or a woman or on any other basis. Old, young, you know, however you want to divide people up. So even though that's the way he's speaking here, I just want you to understand that part. But anyway, he says, the moment you meet a teacher, you should leave the teacher. What do you suppose this means? Meet the teacher, you should leave the teacher. Yeah, Mary?
You should think for yourself.
Always, of course. Think for yourself. Yeah, you shouldn't. The Buddha taught in this way too. Don't believe me just because I told you. Don't believe me just because other people seem to be following me. The point is that you should be, you know, thinking and seeing and testing your own experience for yourself. This is very important. So this is not about following a teacher, becoming some kind of a devotee where you're just worshiping the teacher or something of that sort, where you don't think for yourself or the teacher is always telling you what to do. I knew students when I was, when I first met my teachers, on occasion there would be some people who would, well, they thought the idea was that they could use the teacher, you know, as some kind of a guide or somebody who would think for them or tell them what to do. And a Zen teacher is not going to do that, at least not for long. They might a little bit because they realize you've got some problem here perhaps. But the first thing they're going to try to do is to show you that this doesn't work. The point is that you're the only one who can see. You can't see through someone else's eyes. You have to see for yourself. And this is about awakening. And to be awake, you have to be awake. And you have to see. So it isn't a matter of you interpreting anything that I'm saying. And if I'm actually helping you at all, I'm not even really giving you my opinion about anything. Once in a while I do, and when I do, I try to identify that. But basically, a Zen teacher is just always trying to draw your attention to reality, not explaining it to you, because nobody can explain it to you. Reality can't be explained. It doesn't need to be explained. And because it doesn't need to be explained, you don't really need an explainer. If you have somebody explaining reality to you, then you've got somebody who's trying to sell you something here. Somebody's trying to get you to buy into a particular way of looking at things. Okay, this isn't any particular way of looking at things. This is about you seeing what's actually happening from moment to moment. There's no particular way here, no particular rule, no particular thing to be seen. You have to simply see for yourself. So this is to be independent of the teacher. My teacher used to say that the final job of the teacher is to make the student free of the teacher. This is very important. But he says you need a teacher so that you can become independent. So a teacher plays a role, you know. But a good teacher isn't going to let you attach to the teacher. If you attach to the teacher, or if you start to build the teacher up, or you say, oh, I've got this wonderful teacher, and the teacher becomes something removed from you, something different than what you are, now this isn't the function of a Zen teacher. The function of a Zen teacher is to make you understand that you're exactly the same as the teacher. You really are, right from the start. You're actually the same as the teacher. But you just don't know that. You're not really paying attention. So the teacher's job is to get you to notice that. That you're actually living a real, genuine life yourself, independent of the teacher. And you have to come to see this, you know. So people who would put the teacher up on a pedestal, or sometimes then they would also put the teacher down. I remember another person gave a talk one time describing a Roshi, you know, a Zen teacher. Called him a garbage can. A Roshi, a Zen teacher, is a garbage can. You just dump all your garbage in this person, you know, and they'll take it on. They'll... Well, this is to kind of abuse the teacher. Of course, the teacher has to, if you throw garbage at the teacher's got to take it. So, you know, the teacher understands. A good teacher will understand that. And then whether the teacher likes it or not, and of course, who likes having garbage thrown at them? But you just sit there and take the garbage, you know. Well, then you might get the impression that, well, that's the teacher's job. They just keep soaking up your garbage. No, that's completely wrong, you see, because you have to realize right from the first, you're the same thing as the teacher. Same thing, we're all human beings here. And we can either be awake as human beings or we can be asleep. And so this is all about awakening. That's what Zen is all about. So to be awake, well, this is just your job. Nobody else can do it for you. You have to take that responsibility. And all a teacher can do is just keep kind of pointing things out to you. You know, like you said last week, we kind of went over it, but most Zen students have a hard time with their teacher. It's because a teacher, a Zen teacher, is always kind of hammering on your ego. You know, it's kind of... And what's your ego? Your ego is just, you know, your own point of view coming up. And your own point of view is, well, you're trying to get something from the teacher, trying to put something on the teacher, trying to get something from the teaching, trying to get something from Zen practice, trying to get something from other things in your life, or putting other things down. This is all a very disturbed mind. This is our ordinary, greedy, deluded mind. Zen teaching and Zen practice is all about realizing what it is that we do. That's so painful in life. And that it's always constantly trying to get the best deal, trying to block all the things that we don't want, etc. Instead of really paying attention to what life is constantly dishing up. If you notice that it doesn't matter what you do, the stuff you don't like keeps coming up, the stuff you like keeps coming up. It all keeps coming up. And whether you try to control things, manipulate things, you end up spending a great deal of your time, wasting your time and energy, just trying to control everything that you really can't control. You're ignoring totally the thing that you can control, and that's yourself. You can just watch your own mind. And if you take care of this, life just goes on as it always has anyway. Different kinds of stuff just keep coming up. So whether it's garbage being slung at you or praise, it's all the same. And if you become, as you should, if you understand this teaching, to become like the teacher, not the same, and you are you, but of equal mind, where you're not tossed away by this or that. Well, this is no longer to be tied to the teacher. This is not to be attached to the teacher. This is not to be kind of tugging on the teacher. You will hinder the teacher in the way, not that you hinder the teacher. You can't really hinder the teacher, but you hinder the teacher's ability to teach you anything. So you have to realize that you're doing all the work. You've got to do all the work. I can't do any of the work for you. All I can do is point out things. Yeah. But the rest of it's all up to you. You've got to do the work. But then he says here, if you are not attached to the teacher, then the teacher will show you the way to yourself. This is how the teacher can teach. And you find a way to yourself. In other words, you find out what your actual experience is from moment to moment. This is why finally, with my teacher, there's this kind of a scene in the Dharma transmission ceremony where we bow to each other and we end up bowing together like this as equals. He realized what the mind is, and when the student realizes the same mind, It's not the student's mind, it's not the teacher's mind, it's just reality itself. And when we both see this, then the teacher's done his job. Now you're free, you just go on. But all the while, you always were free. Meaning, you got to do the work. It's as simple as that. So you can't, if you keep expecting the teacher to give something to you, or to kiss your wounds, or you know, something like this, now, they might do it for a while, but sooner or later, you'll get slapped around. You know, that Zen image I think I talked about before, the mama lion throws her babies off the cliff. This is a Zen teacher. Throws her babies off the cliff. And then those that come back, I saw a picture of this one. It's a fantastic painting, you know. Some of the little cubs are down there at the bottom of this gorge or whatever, you know. Some are whimpering and, you know, some are just looking absolutely bewildered, you know. But there's others that are with very earnest, you know, looks on their little faces, you know, crawling back up that cliff, back up to the mama lion. And the story is that she'll teach the ones that come back. So, you know, you gotta watch out for this. Well, just sooner or later, you see, the problem that we have is that you have an ego. See, the problem is you have it, and you gotta notice. You gotta start to notice this, and you have to start to notice how this gets you caught up in pain, in difficulty, in suffering, in confusion. You see, we don't notice that, and so we keep trying to aggrandize this ego, trying to please it. We also try to protect it. So we'll tell stories. You know, we won't talk honestly or directly. You know, we kind of circumvent things, you know. But sooner or later, if you're really doing the work, you gotta stop doing that. You can't continue to do that. And that hurts. And somebody finally has to slap you around for that. Well, it doesn't really hurt, though, if you realize what's going on. You know. You know already that you're confused. You do. So you got to ask yourself the question, well, do I want to go on being confused, or do I want to stop this? And if you ask yourself, well, why is it that you're confused? Well, it's because you're spending all your time not paying attention to what's actually happening, but you're giving most of your attention to protecting yourself and pleasing yourself. Look at that. Well, you watch yourself through the whole day. How much of it is spent in protection and pleasing yourself? This is what we call bondage. And one of the ways that you can become free of this is you start to notice how you keep playing this game. And as a role of a Zen teacher, that's why they don't get along so well with their students. Like he said earlier, a lot of Zen students, the good students, they'll have a hard time with the teacher because the teacher will point out these things to them from time to time. At the bottom of the page, we should remember that the purpose of practice in a particular place is to study ourselves. Well, this is always the point, and to not study yourself, as I said last week, this is not about studying yourself in some kind of a self-help program or some ways to improve yourself. This is not about self-improvement. You can't improve yourself. You're already perfect, so you know, what do you want? But you keep ignoring that. And so you keep thinking that you're limited in some way, and so you got to, this is how you have to kind of improve yourself. You have to aggrandize yourself. You have to, you know, make improvements here. And some of the improvements that you will actually make improvements, and some of the improvements you make will just kind of look like improvements. And we're very good at that. We do a lot of improving where we make it look better, you know. But all of this is pain. All of it is pain. You don't have to improve yourself. All you have to do is just come into this moment, and you will discover that you're perfectly fine right now, as you are. So this is about just looking at ourselves, just studying ourselves, always coming back to this moment, seeing what this moment is. So we need a teacher because it's impossible to study ourselves by ourselves. So a teacher is kind of like a mirror, just keeps reflecting you. But you don't want it. Normally, we play a game of where you hold up kind of we project an image of ourselves, you see? And then, of course, most of the people, they understand the image you're projecting, they'll react to that image, see? And a Zen teacher will do that for a while, but sooner or later they'll react to exactly to what you're showing. They'll show you exactly what you're doing. And that's when you don't like the teacher. You know? But see, you got to realize right from the beginning, you should be independent of the teacher. So that if you're not attached to the teacher, then the teacher can teach you something. If you attach to the teacher, if you think the teacher is really great, you know, something like this, and then the teacher becomes something other than what you are, then the teacher, now the teacher can't reflect you. Whatever the teacher tries to show you, you don't see that. You see something else as false. And then you keep misusing the teacher. You keep dumping things on the teacher or trying to get something from the teacher, and you're ignoring what the teacher's doing. So tell the teacher has to get rough and show you what you're doing. And then you don't like that. And then, of course, then immediately then the teacher goes down here. Now the teacher's like a garbage can. I've seen that. I've seen that with my teacher. People put him up here, and you know, the next thing I know, he's down here. So watch out. Teacher's on exactly the same level you're on, right from the start. They're just doing something a little different. They're trying to pay attention. That's all. And they've developed a little skill at it, maybe. Any questions about that? This is important because this is not ordinary teaching. This is not trying to give you some idea of something. This is about helping you to actually see what's happening from moment to moment. But if you live out your life not studying yourself, not realizing what you are, not realizing the cocoon that you wrap yourself in and the facade that you enclose yourself in, the self-image that you use to speak to yourself about yourself and the other self-image that you use to project yourself to others, etc. This is about noticing how it is that we do this. This is contrary to what we think we're doing. This is the root of sorrow and pain and difficulty in our lives. Just simply this. And not really seeing what it is that's going on here. That you, in fact, you don't need to do this. You don't need to impress anybody. You don't need to shrink from anybody. And this is freedom. Yeah.
That story about the lion makes it sound like part of the teaching is to pour a little extra suffering on people. Is that true or?
Mm-mm. No, absolutely not. You mean making people suffer?
Uh-huh.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And a good teacher is not interested in getting you to suffer any more than you have to. A good teacher, in pointing out your life to you and helping you, just simply helping you see your life, you're going to experience a certain amount of pain through that. But it's a kind of pain of growth. But it's sort of a necessary pain. But this is compassion. This is deep compassion. It's true compassion if it's coupled with wisdom. If it's compassion without wisdom, well, then it's kind of like being the overindulgent parent who, sure, you want your child to enjoy their life, etc., you know, so you keep doing things for them and keep giving them things and whatever, and gradually you're developing a child who's just used to having things done for them, and then sooner or later they have a hard time coping with life because once they get out in life, there's nobody there paving the road for them. In the short run, it seems like, sure, you know, you want to gratify their desires today. You want to do it again today. And today, of course, you do. And again. But if you continue this way, you will really injure that person, you see. But if out of compassion along the way, you show them that, well, you know, you can't always get what you want. And they might throw a little temper tantrum when they're 5 or 6. And this is very difficult. There's no one right way to do this, but the road to maturity emotionally in all ways, it involves a certain amount of pain and difficulty and disappointments along the way, but in the end we grow from it. Well, here on page 78 he said, near the bottom, he said, so to feel something about Buddhism is not the main point. Whether that feeling is good or bad is out of the question. We do not mind whatever it is. So this, you know, when you understand this thing about maturing, you know, that sometimes it involves a certain amount of pain and difficulty, then you don't mind it. Then you realize, well, this is just a part of it. You know, whatever it is. Buddhism is not good or bad. You name it. It's not good or bad. Like, for example, I don't know why, it's just coming to my mind now, but I don't think I've ever talked about this in front of a class before, but a very painful experience for me happened when I was 6 years old. My father died. Suddenly, just unexpectedly, over the weekend, he got sick and died. Got sick on Friday night, dead Monday morning. And it was a big shock for all of us. I was just a little boy, but I remember it quite clearly. It's kind of like I had a nice, happy childhood up till then. Suddenly, my childhood was over. It was the end of it. And extremely painful. Extremely painful. And our whole family is very sad. My oldest brother is trying to console me and my mother, you know. But my point is that while I would never, if I could live my life over and choose the events as they would unfold, I would certainly never choose for my father to die suddenly like that when he was still pretty young. And while this is not something you would choose, on the other hand, when I look back over my life, I learned a lot from this. In fact, I wouldn't be here today like this had this event not taken place in my life. It was when I started getting serious about what's going on here. I was only 6 years old, but I got pretty serious. I realized there was something unpredictable about life. And it took me a long time to get over this one. But in the end, it's through these kinds of difficult times. And, you know, I'm just talking about me. You've all got painful episodes in your life, your stories. We try to shrink from these. We try to blockade ourselves from that. We try to keep all these kinds of things from happening to our children. You know, just cover everyone up. This is what the Buddha's father did to him. You know the story? He was a prince. And his father tried to keep all kinds of pain and suffering from him until he was in his 20s when he discovered he didn't know about death. He didn't know about sickness. He didn't know about, you know, old age. Suddenly he realized what was going on. People get old, they get sick, they die. And he was so shocked by this that he set out to find something you can do about this. And he found something. But the point is that you go through this kind of pain. And we all have it. You know you do. But our normal way of dealing with it is, it's not studying yourself, realizing what you are and what life is. It's to somehow barricade ourselves from it. Keep it from happening. Yes, if you could choose all the events of your life, you'd choose them all to be nice and happy. But at the end of such a life, it'd be pretty bland, I think. You wouldn't appreciate anything. So this is life. We learn from this. And so the Zen teacher, they just kind of help you out with this. They help you out drawing these episodes to your attention, the things you don't want to look at. Because it's the thing you don't want to look at that keeps you fearful, you know, the boogeyman. So, I don't know, any discussion about that? Yeah, Vince.
Well, I'm just struck at how heretical this is in relation to the dominant culture. The whole culture is that...
gratify your desires, yeah.
And if something comes into your life that's unpleasant, well, you know, do
sure.
Whatever you have to do, whatever self-help or whatever that is, to erase it or eradicate it or change it.
Yeah.
I mean, you can imagine commercials saying things like, I'm sorry, everybody doesn't look the same. You know, some people look really good and some people don't. Some people can afford new cars, some people can't.
Yeah.
You know, and if that was the message, you know, on the day.
Well, you see, we'd become a sane society. If that was the message. If that was the message you heard every time you turned around, you know, and you heard it from the time you're a little child, well, you know, little children would pick that up. In no time at all, just take a generation or two, you'd have a sane society. But it's probably not going to happen. It's muddy water. So we got to kind of work on ourselves after the fact. That's where we get all kind of messed up. You know? But this is, yeah, study yourself. That's what this means. Just look, you know, and yourself isn't you, your ego self. And it's not for self-improvement. It's about noticing what's actually happening in this moment. And when you realize it's all this stuff, no matter what, it just keeps coming up. And then you can kind of relax. You don't have to always try to make it go that way and not this way. And now you can deal with it. and you realize that the horrendous stuff isn't really that bad, the wonderful stuff isn't that great. And far from life becoming bland, it actually becomes quite lively, because the stuff does come up. Then it tastes pretty good. It's changing flavors, you know, cold to hot and all that. Makes life rather interesting. So there's no boredom in this. Quite the contrary, when you're always doing this and then going there, you know, now life gets kind of bland. And if you're pretty successful, the more successful you are at getting this balance going the way you want it, the more bland your life gets. Really an insidious thing. Up to a point. You can get a really bland thing here, and then there's images in Buddhism about this. The whole thing will flip over. And you go into the worst possible state of mind. You want to go into one of the cold hells. You know, well, never mind. The hells and heavens and things, realms like this in Buddhism, they're states of mind. They're not places you go to. It's your state of mind. But the state of mind that you want, the state of mind of reality, is a human mind. You want a human mind. Of course, you have a human mind, you understand? So relax. You know? But we always want like a heavenly mind. Of course, we end up becoming kind of greedy, so we end up with what's called a hungry ghost mind, you know? Hungry ghosts, they got these big bellies and little tiny mouths, and they just can't feed themselves enough, you know? They just can't, you know? Or we get animal mind, which is, you know, we live our lives in fear, you know? Well, anyway, boy, I'm really getting sidetracked here. Well, I want to get into this next section here on communication, page 86, near the bottom. He said, we say that if you do not understand your master's words, you are not his disciple. Now, he used the word master here. My teacher, Katagiri Roshi, he hated that word, Zen master. He hated that, you know. And if you ever use it, he'd just wrinkle up his face. And no one can master his life, you know, he'd say so. But anyway, he uses the term here, Zen master. But I don't know, I'm not particularly fond of it, the term either, actually. But we say that if you do not understand your master's words, you are not his disciple. So yeah, you have to understand what the teacher is saying. But you notice that what the teacher is really trying to say cannot be said. Do you notice this? This is one of the reasons that a lot of the things the teachers say, you know, if you track them very logically, it leaves you wondering, you know, what are you talking about? It's like the one that you found so annoying last week that, what was it, to study Buddhism is not to study Buddhism. What's the teacher saying? That sounds like so much nonsense, you know. But if you look carefully at what he's saying, there's a subtlety in it that's really profound, and it really strikes right at the actual reality of your life. Yeah, to study Buddhism is not to study Buddhism. But anyway, so if you don't understand your master's words, if you don't understand what the teacher is saying, then you're not his disciple. To understand your master's words or your master's language is to understand your master himself. And this is ultimately the job of the teacher. This takes time. Years, generally. But gradually, you can understand the teacher's language. And you can begin to use this language yourself. It's not the language of that particular teacher, even. It's just the language of reality itself. It's called Dharma, or Buddha Dharma. And then you can use this language. And when you understand him, you find his language is not just ordinary language. No, it's but language in its wider sense. In other words, our ordinary language is a language of delusion. We constantly pick up something in a word and we manipulate it or we change it, we move it around, and we think we're actually talking about reality. And all the while, we're deluded. See, but there's this different kind of language. It's called Buddha Dharma. It doesn't even presume to be doing that at all. And of course, when we first listen to it, we're always listening to it in our ordinary way, and we think that it sounds like the same language, using nouns and pronouns and verbs and things, and sentence structure generally follows it, though some Zen masters really murder the grammar. That's another story. But it sounds like language, ordinary language, you know, and we follow it like ordinary language, but you have a hard time understanding, you know, that language. So when you listen to Dharma teaching, you got to kind of loosen up. I mean, the words have to... Like Thoreau used an interesting term. He talked about giving a wide margin to your words. I kind of like that phrase. I don't know if he meant it quite like this, but But instead of having your words, the words you hear, as well as the words you speak, come on and as hard nuggets like this, you know, and to hit some kind of precise meaning with your words, they should be kind of thrown out there loosely. Also, when you hear the words being spoken, take them in kind of loosely. Don't try to grab onto some specific meaning here. This is what we ordinarily do when we hear and when we speak. We're always trying to say it exactly so. And then when someone says it, of course, even though they had a different idea in mind, but you picked it up in this way, and by golly, that's, you know, how you see it. We should realize right from the start, this is all delusion. And if we realize how deluded we are and we get caught up in this way, we let these words kind of soften up a little bit and kind of put them in a solution, let them soak for a while. And they soften up. You know, the words get softer. And they get more spongy. They have a wider margin around them, see? And they don't hurt so much when they get thrown at you, you know? They become spongy words. And can bounce off, you know? Yeah. Huh?
Nerf words.
Nerf words, yes. Yeah, there you go. But you find his language not just ordinary language, but the language in its wider sense. Through your master's language, you understand more than what his words actually say. So we're just a little bit too literal. For example, there's a famous koan. The Zen master says to this fellow, shows up. The master said to him, said, where are you from? Well, you know, Zen master says that to you, you better watch out. Because the guy said, I'm from Tangshan or something. He'd be like saying, I'm from Minneapolis, you know. And the Zen master said, well, what is it that thus comes? And the guy, you know, now he's lost, you know. Couldn't say anything for 8 years after that, you know, this particular fellow. He was a good student, you know. He was serious. What's this guy saying to me? And then finally he woke up as a result of this. And after 8 years he said, even to say it is something doesn't hit the mark. Well, anyway, but this is the kind of language of a Zen master, you see, that he's not asking, well, he might be asking you, well, where are you from, Minneapolis, St. Paul, where are you from, you know, but maybe not. So you have to be careful here, be a little loose with this, because what the student woke up to is that even to say it is something, that doesn't hit the mark. You can't speak reality. You can't say what it is. What are you? Where did you come from? You can't say. Of course, you think you can. We answer all kinds of questions regarding this. And within relative context, you know, sure, it's fine. I'm from Minneapolis. Works pretty well. At least in my case. For the time being, anyway. But when we're interested in Dharma teaching, Zen teaching, we have to realize that these words, they're constantly trying to bring us out of our conceptual reality, and they're trying to point out something very profound and real. And that is, like in this particular case, what are you? Where are you from? And of course, he finally realized, well, even to say something here doesn't hit the mark. Now look at that understanding that he arrived at there. He didn't say that, I can't say. Yeah, you can say something, but even to say something doesn't do it. But we go on talking like we think we can actually say something. And in fact, we can't. And this is a very difficult teaching because, you see, if you really offer this teaching properly, you're not really saying anything at all in the ordinary way. But this teaching is saying something, and you know it is because you're getting a great deal out of it. You know that. You feel it. And you are learning something. And at a certain point, if you continue to hang in there with this teaching, continue to look at it, you will suddenly acquire the language yourself. And you will be able to speak Dharma. But it says, when we say something, our intention or situation is always involved. Well, this is a problem. This is the difference between Dharma speaking of reality, the teaching of the awakened, and ordinary speech. Our ordinary speech is from our own subjective point of view. It's our opinion, whatever. It's loaded with intention, meaning of mind. It's always assuming that there's actually something here that you can really pin down and move around. But in reality, we can. Now, this doesn't mean that we can't use language in our conventional way. We can, and it's fine. But we should wake up to the fact that we don't have to get too hot and bothered over this, and we can kind of relax and realize that we never pin down reality in the way that we think we can. And this is a source of pain, confusion for us.
He said, through our master statement, we have to understand objective fact. You understand objective fact, not subjective, not the teacher's opinion. The Dharma is not anybody's opinion. It's not the Buddha's opinion. It's not my opinion. It's not the teacher's opinion. It's just objective fact because it isn't in the words. We don't find the truth in the words of the Buddha. We don't find... This is why the Buddha likened his teaching to a raft once again. You know, and get rid of the raft. We can't speak the truth as such. But words can be used to draw our attention to what's actually taking place. And here's where we find the truth. Something as faulty and wrapped up in delusion as language is can be used to actually teach Dharma. Okay, so the master's statement, we have to understand through that objective fact, ultimate fact, he said. By ultimate fact, we do not mean something eternal or something constant. We mean things as they are in each moment. You know, so that it isn't about something that, now once we've stated it, that's it. You know, forever and ever, this is the truth, brother, sister, believe it, this is it. No, that's how we think language can be used. When we speak, we think we're talking in that way, and we think, well, give me the truth, let me write it down here. Let me put it in this book. You know, here's the holy book of the truth, you see. And we treat language as if it can be used in that way. Even in just our ordinary speech, we talk and we use language as if we were actually dealing with actual truth in the language. But we never are. Never are, right from the start. And we should realize that. But he said, this ultimate fact is just things as they are in each moment. And then he says, you can call it being. I don't know if I like that term so much. Or reality. To understand reality as a direct experience is the reason we practice Zazen and the reason why we study Buddhism. So that's what this is about. This is why we study this. It's about learning to see what reality is. And reality is the actual experience that we have from moment to moment. And that is something we don't get through words. But encountering a teacher, encountering this teaching, having it pointed out to you is very, very helpful for us because we otherwise wouldn't learn. I don't think, I know, I wouldn't be sitting here now talking to you like this had I not encountered my teacher. So, yeah, had my father not died when I was six, had I not encountered my teacher, all many things here. Many kind of teachings and teachers that I've experienced in my life brought me to this point where I can do this. So we need a teacher. We need events, painful as they are, running into a teacher, painful as that is. But this is all kind of necessary for us. Of course, some of us are really geniuses and some spiritual geniuses who can wake up spontaneously on our own. That's pretty rare. It can happen, but I wouldn't count on it. You better play Powerball or something like that. You have a bunch better odds. Okay, but continuing on then on page 87, he said, only by the actual practice of Zen can you experience reality directly and understand in their true sense the various statements made by your teacher or by a Buddha. He said, only by the actual practice of Zen can you experience reality directly. Does that sound kind of arrogant? Yeah, I think so too. But if you just reverse it, what he's really saying here, it actually isn't. He's saying that to experience, by definition, to experience reality directly is, that's what Zen is. Zen is to experience reality directly. That's the whole point of Zen. That's what this is about. So from that standpoint, I don't think it's quite as arrogant as it might otherwise sound. I didn't quite say that right, though. The fact of the matter is you already are experiencing reality directly. You could not be experiencing reality directly. But Zen is about being there with it. That's why I haven't shown you this form of meditation yet, but after about the third year or so, when you're kind of used to sitting in meditation, we go on to this kind of meditation called Shikantaza, in which the whole point of this meditation is just simply to be there in reality. You just simply come into this moment and be there in reality. Now, I can't really teach you that. That's why I kind of hold it off for a while. Nobody can teach you this. You just simply have to start to do this. But through your meditation and through allowing the meditation to teach you the meditation, you go into more profound and subtle understanding and experience of meditation, until finally you start doing this thing called a shikantaza, which just simply means, literally, it just means just sitting. It's not exactly following the breath anymore. It's just simply being here. But at this point, now this is actual doing zazen. So we do a lot of bogus zazen for a long time on our way, but it's not a bad thing until we can actually do real zazen. And this is what he's talking about here. So it's only when he says the actual practice of Zen. So that's what he means by the actual practice of Zen is just this. And what is it? Well, another name for it is this direct experience of reality, or actually understanding, realizing what the actual direct experience of reality is. So in the meantime, we do this other practice, meditation, where we kind of hone our skills of concentration and mindfulness, etc., and little by little, the different kinds of distractions and anomalies of mind begin to drop away, until finally we can just actually sit there in reality itself, which of course you're already doing, but you're just not really paying enough attention. There's too much distraction. The mind is constantly thinking about this or going off here or there, and that keeps us from actually being in this moment. It is not possible to speak about reality. He says, nevertheless, if you are a Zen student, you have to understand it directly. So this is ultimately what Zen is about, to bring us to this point where we directly understand the actual experience that goes on in this moment. That's called enlightenment or awakening. And you really see what's actually happening. It isn't what you think is happening. It's to finally realize, you know, it's to see how it is that you do the thinking, you know, and you're always packaging reality, you're always conceptualizing reality. So this is to see how it is that you do that. So now you realize what the conceptual reality is. And when you can finally see what the conceptual reality is, in other words, your delusion, now we call this being awake. But being awake isn't inseparable from this delusion. It's just simply seeing it. So it needs delusion there in order to be in a state of awakening. But it's just simply seeing what that delusion is. What we call delusion is just simply being caught up in the delusion so we don't see it. And part of the things that we're caught up with in delusion is a view of enlightenment. So we have this view of enlightenment when we're deluded. But if you actually wake up, there's no view of enlightenment. Enlightenment disappears. And it's just delusion there. Does that make any sense? I said your masters may not always speak in words. You know, so teachers teaching in many ways. Like one of my Dharma brothers, Norm Randolph, is a great man. And sometime in the future, I hope, you know, if we have a place that I want to have him, I want to introduce you to him. But there's a guy who teaches. He gives good talks, too. But just good to be around a guy like this. You got to watch him. Watch how he moves and what he does and how he lives his life. He's a guy who just teaches with his body, instead of with his mind and with his words. Well, he teaches that way too. So there's many ways to teach, but he has a pretty good understanding of this stuff. It says when you listen to someone, here's the other side of it. Now we talk about this in the course on the Eightfold Noble Path. We talk about right speech. We talk about part of right speech is right listening. He kind of talks about this here. He says when you listen to someone, you should give up all your preconceived ideas and your subjective opinions. You know, you probably know this story of the guy who comes to see the Zen master, and the Zen master starts pouring tea, and pretty soon the cup's overflowing, and, you know, it's running all over the table and everything. And he says, stop. He said, no more will go in, you know, the cup. And the Zen master said, well, like this cup, your mind is so full of things, nothing will go in. This is really especially true with Zen teaching. If I were teaching you concepts and ideas, and you got some in here, and then these will come in and kind of, well, bump these out of your mind, see? Finally, that's gone, though. Now you got this idea, you know, and maybe others will come in and bump this out, or sometimes they merge, and they do all kinds of things, you see? But Zen teaching doesn't work that way. Zen teaching is, if you got an idea in your mind, then this stuff just kind of flows right over the top, like it doesn't go in at all. See, so you really got to get rid of this stuff. And so that's the first thing you have to do. In the Zen training, you have to really learn to empty this cup. And the way to do that is that there's nothing you to do, really, other than just start watching your mind. Start noticing all this stuff you got there. So when something comes in and you start to watch how you begin to interpret things, you know, you begin to put something on the speaker, or you begin to think, well, wait a minute, I want this, or, you know, you're dealing with it as if it were some kind of a solid thing and you want it to interact with the stuff you've already got in your mind. So what you really have to do is just kind of get rid of all that, not get rid of it, but you have to notice how it is that this kind of teaching here is constantly interacting with the stuff that's already in your mind. You're just basically kind of listening to yourself, which I think, that's what he says at the bottom of the pages, is usually when we listen to some statement you hear, it's just a kind of echo of yourself. And that's what we're listening to. So Zen teaching comes in, and it doesn't come in, it just kind of glances off the, you know, and the stuff that starts vibrating in your mind is just stuff that you always thought. You know, and maybe just kind of get a little modification. So with Zen teaching and Zen practice is we got to learn to empty our cup. Empty the cup of the mind, which is done by examining your mind, the contents of your mind. Just start looking at that. And when you do, it isn't like you got to throw this stuff out or anything. It just kind of gradually, it just sort of gets transparent and kind of fades away. Gets kind of misty and smoky and just kind of fades away. then as it gets mistier and smokier and more transparent, then you can start to absorb what's being said here. You can begin to see, absorb might be wrong, but you can begin to see what's actually being taught here. So this all works together. You encounter this teaching, keep reading this and studying it and listening to such talks and things, and at the same time do this in conjunction with the actual practice of meditation, where you are learning to examine your own mind, the contents of your own mind. And so that stuff becomes less and less of an interference. Otherwise, if you just keep indulging yourself in your own prejudices and your likes and dislikes, etc., and your favorite theories about everything and whatever, this teaching will never hit you. Yeah.
How does the unconscious mind work in this? I mean, I hear you, the way you're talking about it, but mostly conscious mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where is this mind?
Pardon?
Well, unconscious mind. We talk about unconscious mind. I know it's kind of popular in our psychology and that, and from Freud and all this. But there isn't any unconscious mind. What we call unconscious mind is just the mind that we're not paying attention. If you turn your attention toward your mind, you will find there's nothing in the mind that's unconscious. It's all sitting right there in the open. So there's really no unconscious mind. We think there is. And we think that this Buddhist psychology is radically different from our psychology. But we think, and we think that buried down deep in this subconscious, we got all these hard nuggets of things down there. And if they're not arranged right, they keep coming up and they mess us up and stuff like that. So we got to go in there and get down into that subconscious mind and straighten it up. That's what we think, you know. That's kind of how Western psychology works. I mean, probably a highly simplified view, but in Buddhism, that image doesn't appear at all. The mind isn't structured that way at all, from Buddhist understanding. That there's really, strictly speaking, no unconscious. Because if there's a thing called the unconscious mind, by its very nature, it's kind of like a black hole or something. I mean, what is it that you're talking about? We presume there's something there hidden in my mind that's keeping me, that might cause me to do this or do that, and I don't really quite know, you know, where this is coming from, but it's kind of buried down there deep in my mind, etc. But that's not, all you got to do is learn to observe your mind, you know, and it's kind of like you got this searchlight, you can look wherever you want.
and everything's in the open. There's nothing hidden. There's no lid over a portion of the mind that keeps the mind unconscious. The mind by nature is conscious. That's mind, it's consciousness. So there can't be a part of it that's unconscious. Okay? Why don't you argue with me?
I wanted to argue because I think when you create art, it is really comes from unconscious mind. I'm an artist and that's mm-hmm. how I work. So when you say, a lot of times I don't know how the stuff is coming out, and when it's there and it's finished, it's conscious. But before then, I would not, through my ordinary mind, I never get to that material.
Oh, I agree. Yes. Yeah, no, you don't through your ordinary mind. Yeah. Now, if you're speaking of mind that's not your mind, oh, absolutely, yeah. But that mind also isn't unconscious. That mind is just sitting right there in the open too. Yeah, and it's quite true. Yeah, you don't know where that's coming from. That's yeah. true. Yeah. No, I understand that.
Is that like
yeah.
inspiration?
Yeah, but that's not. I suppose we can say inspiration, but that's like that's a different thing than to say that there's actually a hunk of the mind here that's sitting here in the dark that things are shooting out of it. That's a different matter altogether.
No mind.
Huh?
It's no mind.
Well, sometimes it's called no mind, but the stuff you're picking up, it's actual mind itself, which isn't your mind. It's apart from your ego mind. There's mind itself, and then there's your mind. And your mind is your conscious mind that you're aware of personally. It's your own personal thoughts, your calculating mind, your thinking mind, all of that, and your emotional mind, etc. Yeah, but now there's mind itself, which is huge and vast, and everything is sitting there. But it's not this other mind that we're speaking of. He calls it big mind here. Is not, strictly speaking, is not something other than your mind. Because, not for you, the reason you might think, it's not something other than your mind in the sense that, strictly speaking, your mind doesn't exist. There is no such thing called your mind, actually. The your mind part of it is an illusion that's created by mind itself. But we're kind of getting into an area of Buddhist psychology that I don't have time to lay out, but I'm going to put a course together on this eventually, I think, I hope. But anyway, basically, I guess what I'm trying to say is the image of the unconscious mind is something that doesn't quite fit with this understanding here. It's a misunderstanding of that experience. But it is quite true, yeah. Stuff comes up out of places where it seems to be coming from nowhere in particular. That's quite true. And then we can call it inspiration, etc. But it's actually coming right out of the whole mind. The whole mind just working. And it's not your personal mind. That's why you say, well, I don't know where this came from. Yeah, because it's not part of your mind. But it didn't come out of the unconscious. It didn't come out of some place that's existing in some mystery hole, somewhere like that. That's not the case. That's the point I'm trying to make. I don't know if I'm making it clear or not. There's not a dark spot there that we'll never get into, that always remains unconscious. If that were the case, then how can we even talk about how, there's no experience of such a thing as that. By its nature, by its definition, there's no such thing as that. We can't have such a thing as that.
See, what you're saying is it's kind of a contradiction in terms. If mind is consciousness, to say you have an unconscious consciousness.
Yeah, a characteristic of mind is one of the characteristics of consciousness. So how can you have a part of it that's not?
Remember the line from the movie Awakening? Someone accuses Robert De Niro is meeting with psychologists, and one of them says to him, "Are you aware of your unconscious hostility toward us?" Just scratches his head and says, "Well, if it's unconscious, how could I be aware of it?"
Yeah. But then there you are. If there is hostility, you see, then in what sense can we say it's even unconscious? You can say the guy's not paying attention, perhaps. Yeah, something like that. But it's not. There's nothing unconscious. Because if something shows up, well, there is. I mean, And then you say, well, it isn't sure. Well, what are you talking about now? You see, so it's kind of like that. And that's the problem that we have here. I think I'll just move ahead into the next section. And he talks about negative and positive.
He said, the more you understand our thinking, or this kind of, what do we say, Zen thing, the more you find it difficult to talk about it. And this is really true. I mean, as you understand this kind of teaching, it gets more and more difficult to say anything at all about it. But the more you hear the language of Dharma, this language, and at first it sounds like ordinary language, you know, so you're getting a lot out of it, you know, and you notice too yourself, maybe you've noticed, and you come to these classes and you start getting quieter and quieter, driving me crazy. You're getting too quiet. Sometimes you won't ask any questions, which I like to get so I know what you're understanding, but it's true. Generally we get quieter and quieter to a point, and I remember there was a point in my case finally where I became kind of speechless. I couldn't talk about this at all when I finally I could see what this teaching was, and then I couldn't say anything about it.
So this probably wouldn't be
the thesis topic. No. No, I got a story about that, but I'm not going to tell it. But but no, it's not a very good thesis topic, especially when you write one word and no. But you know, about a year went by, and I couldn't talk at all about any of this stuff. And finally, I went to my teacher and I talked a little bit, and then. And we spoke a little bit, and then I told him, I said, you know, we can't talk about this. And he said, well, you have to say something, he said. He said, if you don't say anything, nobody will understand, you know. So so then I finally learned to talk. So that's why I'm here, you know. But you acquire the sign. But he said, the more you understand our thinking, the more you find it difficult to talk about it. Because if you try to use ordinary language, it doesn't work. But if you actually understand the profound truth of this moment and you understand what this teaching is, then you can begin to speak once again. He said, when we talk about our way, there's apt to be some misunderstanding because the true way always has at least two sides. So the Zen teaching, oftentimes it has... Did I give the example of the whisk up and the whisk down in this class? I can't remember. I used it somewhere. No, but like the Zen teacher, one Zen teacher said to the other, he said, show me your Zen, you know, and the teacher holds up his whisk. and then the other teacher said to him, is that all you understand? You know, and the teacher put his whisk down again. So two sides, you know, you don't understand. But there's two sides to this teaching. He said we cannot speak in a pot. Dogen talks about it in the Genjo Koan, where the realization of ultimate reality. He talks about when one side comes forward, the other side is in darkness. You see, so if you speak of this, then this is in darkness. And when we're not fully awake, when we're in our delusion, we speak of this, thinking that we're speaking of this, that this is it, and we forget this is in darkness. We're ignoring this entirely. But this over here that's in darkness is actually part of this thing here. It's like two sides of a coin. It's like we go through life always wanting heads, you know, and not realizing that, well, if you want heads, you got to have tails as well. So but the problem is when we speak in a negative way, is there at the same time, you said. So it is almost impossible to talk about Buddhism. So not to say anything, just practice it. That's the best way, he said. A little further down, he said, to talk about something will be one of our practices, and to listen to the talk will also be a practice. So once again, we have to listen to these two sides of everything that's taking place in each moment. He said, we just talk without trying to express some intellectual or one-sided idea. We're not... You know, in our ordinary way, when we're talking, we're expressing this idea here, you know, and we think that that's all there is. I want you to understand this point, you see. But when a Zen teacher is talking, they're talking this, but they're fully aware of this that they're not saying, you see, and you have to develop an ear so you're hearing this as well. And sometimes they'll talk over here. And sometimes you say, well, the teacher's talking contradiction, because one day they're talking over here, next day they're talking over here, but there's not a contradiction there. When we get into some more advanced teachings, some courses I'll be teaching later on, there's a particular piece, Sandokai, so the merging of difference and unity, or inner identity of absolute and relative. And this particular text, they talk in a particular way. He starts out talking this way about enlightenment. He's talking about it over here in a very unusual way. I mean, a very usual way. He's talking about enlightenment as light. And as you keep working your way through the poem, all of a sudden the author now begins to talk about enlightenment as darkness. You see? And first of all, it's so obscure that you probably haven't noticed that he switched. But as you keep working your way through this poem, suddenly now he's talking about enlightenment as the merging of light and dark. And in Chinese, they use a lot of what are called turning words. You know, they'll use a word that can be used in a particular way that it looks like this on the face of it, but that very same word will have its opposite meaning. We actually have such words like that in English. I only knew one for many years, until finally in a class where I was teaching this, I asked if anybody knew of any other such words, and the guy gave me this list that he had, and I copied a few of these words down here that I just wanted to, like for example, a turning word is a word like clip, for example. Clip means to what? You cut, you divide in two, right? Or it can also mean you clip together. You know, you clip two pieces together. So, turning word, you see. And this particular poem in the Chinese where he's talking about light and dark, it's a turning word. And so it's carrying these two meanings. And one at one time it's coming at you looking this way, and the next time he's talking about all of a sudden it's over here. And it means the other. But in English it's coming out light or dark, something like this. But then finally it merges. Well, I can't get into that now because we're not dealing with it in this course, but yeah.
Could we say that ordinary language forces us into the dualism that we talked about?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Well, language forces us into in embracing one side. And sometimes we'll see the opposite and then we'll settle on one side. But now what we're talking about this on a far more subtle level at this point, where in our actual speaking, we're talking this way. With our ordinary speaking, we're ignoring this whole other aspect of reality that isn't coming through in our words. And in some of these very subtle texts early texts in Zen, in the Chinese, where they're using these turning words, you know, they're actually playing with this kind of subtlety. But the point is that the reality we live in is actually just like this. The words that we have now in English, somebody I read somewhere, they said that in ancient times, in very ancient languages, very far back, they had many of these turning words. In our modern language, they've become more and more refined, and more that this just simply means that, and we don't see the opposite side. So these words that tend to still have this dual aspect to them, they're kind of primitive words in many ways, like clip. You know, there's another one here, bolt. Bolt means to run, right? And also means to fasten together. You know? Another one is weather. Weather means to wear away, to weather a rock. And weather also means like to endure, like we weathered the storm. Anyways, moot. Moot means both that it's debatable and that it's also not worthy of debate, you know. So turning words. But the point, there's a subtlety to this. This positive and negative he's talking about here is that this kind of teaching is pointing out the fact that we're living, the reality that we live in is already a merger of all opposites together at once. Our conceptualizing mind is nothing more. Consciousness, from a Buddhist standpoint, Buddhist psychology, is nothing more than this splitting of the actual experience into one part or another. And now we tend to lock on to one aspect and ignore the fact that the other aspect that has slipped into darkness now, as Dogen would put it, we act as if, well, we don't just simply act as if it isn't there. In our delusion, we don't even know it's there. And enlightenment is basically
to realize that this other aspect is always present in reality. In other words, the whole is the reality, and the whole is always present in everything. And this becomes quite serious in matters of, say, like, for example, we look at something like life or death. He's going to talk about this later, which I thought I'd get to tonight, but I'm not. But here's another example. Like my teacher used to say, and this is a kind of common understanding, that what Buddhism is about, Buddhism is basically about the problem of life and death, because this is when this dual aspect of reality becomes very critical for us. And it's, you know, it's very frightening, very troubling. What's the biggest problem you have? Well, it has probably to do with life and death. The fact that you're going to die, you know, your loved ones are going to die. Some of them will die before you, etc. This is a big problem for human beings. But because we habitually lock on to this aspect and ignore that aspect, or not even, not just simply ignore, but we're oblivious to this other dimension or other aspect of reality that's always present with it, we have a great deal of trouble here with this. But what we don't notice is that if we could actually see the reality of each moment that we're living in, the whole thing is there together at once. And the whole thing includes all of the past, the future, the full dimension. Everything is here in this moment together right now at once. This is the enlightened view. This is the view of a Buddha. This is what awakening is to understand and to realize that in each moment, the whole is always present and working in each moment. If you were to actually see what this moment is, the fear of death is gone, the confusion about all of that, where I came from, you know, where it's all going to, etc. All of this, we're freed from this only in seeing the fullness of the moment that we're experiencing. This is what awakening is. And there are many texts which I'll be showing you in the future, if you continue to study with me anyway, that we'll go into this kind of teaching. And basically, Zen teaching is always coming from this standpoint. You should try to develop a little sense of this, so as you encounter Zen teachings, you will realize that a Zen master, whenever they're speaking dharmically, they're always speaking out of this whole space. There's always this other aspect that's hidden behind what they're saying. Like in asking you, where did you come from? Well, there is this hidden aspect behind that, showing that you don't come from anywhere. Within this whole, already you yourself, whatever you are already inseparable from the whole picture. This is the reality that we're constantly living in. This is the reality that this teaching is constantly pointing to. So we should begin to appreciate and understand this dimension, this aspect of the teaching, if we're going to really appreciate what these Zen masters are telling us. So anyway, turning words. I guess I'll just end there for tonight. I think we got a minute. Anybody have a question? A little brief one?
Kind of abstract. We mentioned how language kind of forces thinking in duality.
Mm-hmm.
Do some languages do this more than others?
Well, all languages do it, I suppose. But like I said, I think older languages that are more rich in these kind of turning words and turning terms, it seems to me that these kinds of terms are probably closer to the actual experience that we're in. It leaves me at times wondering if perhaps primitive people were just simply closer to reality than we are, that we're much more caught up in our heads and in our intellects than they were in ancient times. Because from my understanding, I'm not a linguist or anything, I haven't really studied languages, but from my understanding is that when we go into more ancient languages, we find these kinds of terms. But language itself is dualistic right from the start. The moment you name something, you point out something, you're separating one thing out from another. This is to play into the delusion. But once again, to remember, delusion, it shouldn't be seen as a negative thing. Delusion has this positive aspect to it as well. Delusion also has to be seen within the whole context. So we cannot say delusion is a bad thing. But if we only see the delusion, if we're caught up in the delusion, this is equated with, isn't that, this is suffering, this is pain, this is misery, this is confusion, this is fear and anxiety. And that's the problem that we have in Buddhism. And Buddhism is out to set us straight on this one so that we can actually see the reality that we are living from moment to moment. And in so doing, we're freed of all of that, freed of the fear, the confusion, the pain. And we live in radically different ways, far more sane ways. So that's the point here. Kind of a long, drawn-out answer to your question, but basically, I guess the answer is I don't know. I don't know if there's any language that's less so. I've heard people say that like Japanese is more conducive, but I don't know. From my understanding, I don't know if that's, you know, actually I could go on about this, so I better stop here. But I don't know if there's any truth to that. Anyway, thank you very much. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.